Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. From 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, here on UCY.TV Radio, we relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Fission radio show. Today is February 21st, 2018. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here on the West Coast. And yes, it's me. Jerome called me this morning, not feeling well. He lives in a place where they're getting pretty heavily geoengineered. So he asked if I could be on again. He will be with you tomorrow. So I am actually just jumping in within the last few minutes, had no idea. So I, as I'm wont to do, basically I'm going to talk to you about something that's been on my mind. And I went to The Intercept, and I don't know if many of you know about The Intercept, but it is an online journal, essentially, and they have a podcast. It is a Don't Miss podcast. Jeremy Scahill and Naomi Klein and Gren Greenwald, I believe, are the founding people of it. And they have tremendously great investigative reporting there that affects us all. And, you know, one of the things I sort of ranted and raved about yesterday was this idea that the whole thing about guns and the nuclear industry, it's all sort of mixed in together. One of the things that Jerome and I were talking about this morning was the climate change issue that's going on. You know, in the United States, we hear that it's a big hoax, that it's up in the air, that we're being forced into this idea that humans are causing the climate to change. Well, actually, that is not the fact. The fact is 99% of every scientist who studied this issue have all concurred that in one way or another, humans are definitely affecting the climate. And I would say it's much more than just the climate. It is everything. We are beyond the tipping point of where we're at with our civilization in terms of what we're doing. And so based on that, I really, you know, I went to the nuclear alerts right away. It's the usual. I mean, I don't know how many of you know that Indian Point had a very serious automatic critical shutdown last week. And, you know, these nuclear power facilities, we're not going to be told when they melt down. We're not going to be told when they have issues. We're not going to be told when they're leaking. You're not going to be told that you've been poisoned. Let me see, where is that article that I got? I got a whole... Let me see if I can find it again. Oh my gosh. I always do this. I get this really great idea to show you something, and then right before I go on the air, I lose it. But let me see what it was yesterday. There was a cleanup of the most challenging contaminated sites. This is a document that I got from Patty Amino, actually. She was doing some research, and it's from the National Academy of Sciences. The date was November 8th, 2012. It's called Cleanup of the Most Challenging U.S. Contaminated Groundwater Sites, Unlikely for Many Decades. That was the title of it, is pretty shocking just on its own, and it'll just infuriate you. So I thought I'd read a little bit from that. Let me give out our phone number in case anybody wants to give us a call. It's 718-717-8106. You can call in and we can discuss anything that you want. We can take it off topic, or we can remain on topic of whatever it is that I'm reading. This is kind of a lengthy article. Well, not altogether. I'll read it. I'm gonna read this whole article to you so you can see where we're at now. Consider this. We're in 2018. This article was written 6 years ago. And I think whoever wrote this is pretty accurate. So let me just get into it, because this has some pretty interesting information. It says, for immediate release, that's the kind of laughable thing, Washington, at least 126,000 sites across the United States have contaminated groundwater that require remediation, and about 10% of these sites are considered complex, meaning restoration is unlikely to be achieved in the next 50 to 100 years due to technological limitations, says a new report from the National Research Council. The report adds that the estimated cost of complete cleanup at these sites range from $110 billion to $127 billion, but the figures for both the number of sites and the costs are likely underestimated. Several national and state underground cleanup programs developed over the last three decades under various federal and state agencies aim to mitigate the human health and ecological risks posed by underground contamination. These programs include cleanup at Superfund sites, facilities that treat, store, and dispose of hazardous waste, leaking underground storage tanks, and federal facilities such as military installations. The U.S. Department of Defense has already spent approximately $30 billion in hazardous waste remediation to address past legacies of its industrial operations. DOD sites represent approximately 3.4% of the total active remediation sites, but many of these sites present the greatest technological challenges to restoration with very high costs. Therefore, the agency asked the National Research Council to examine the groundwater remediation efforts and the challenges facing the U.S. Army and other responsible agencies as they pursue site closures. The complete removal of contaminants from underground is possibly thousands of complex sites in the U.S. is unlikely. Wow. I guess that's what they told St. Louis, isn't it? The complete removal of contaminants from underground, from groundwater. I'm reading it again because I know I messed it up. So I'm going to go back to the front of that sentence. The complete removal of contaminants from groundwater at possibly thousands of complex sites in the U.S. is unlikely, and no technology innovations appear in the near time horizon that could overcome the challenges of restoring contaminated groundwater to drinking water standards, said Michael Cavanaugh, the chair of the committee that wrote the report and a principal of the Geosyntec Consultants, Inc. in Oakland, California. At many of these complex sites, a point of diminishing return will often recur as contaminants in groundwater remain stalled at levels above drinking water level standards. despite continued active remedial efforts. We are recommending a formal evaluation be made at the appropriate time in the life cycle of a site to decide whether to transition the site to active or passive long-term management. The estimated range of remediation costs do not account for technical barriers to complete cleanup at complex sites or the costs of cleanup at future sites where groundwater may become contaminated, the committee said. A substantial portion of the costs will come from public sources, like taxes, at some complex sites, as some complex sites are orphan sites, and many other complex sites are the responsibility of federal or state agencies. The committee said that the nomenclature for the phrases of site cleanup and cleanup progress are inconsistent among public and private sector organizations, which could confuse the public and other stakeholders about the concept of site closure. For example, many sites thought of as closed and considered successes still have contamination and will require oversight and funding over extended time frames in order to maintain protectiveness, including 50% of the contaminated groundwater sites evaluated by the committee that had been deleted from the Superfund list. Wow. Let me read that again. For example, many sites thought of as closed and considered successes still have contamination and will require continued oversight and funding over extended time frames in order to maintain protectiveness, including 50% of the contaminated groundwater sites evaluated by the committee that have been deleted from the Superfund list. More consistent and transparent terminology that simply and clearly explains the different stages of cleanup and progress would improve communication with the public. I don't think they really want improved communication with the public. The central theme of this report is how the nation should deal with those sites where residual contamination will remain above levels needed to restore restoration, Kavanaugh said. In the opinion of this committee, the finding needs to inform decision-making at these complex sites, including a more complex use of risk assessment methods and support for a national research and development program that leads to innovative tools to ensure protectiveness where residual contamination persists. In all cases, the final end state of these sites are to be protective of human health and the environment consistent with the existing legal framework. But a more rapid transition will reduce life cycle costs. Some residual contamination will persist at these sites, and future national strategies need to account for this fact. The committee said that if a remedy at the site reaches a point where continuing expenditures bring little or no reduction of risk prior to attaining drinking water standards, a reevaluation of the future approach to cleaning up the site called a transition assessment should occur. The committee concluded that cost savings are anticipated from timelier implementation of the transition assessment process, but funding will still need to be maintained long-term management at these complex sites. The report was sponsored by the U.S. Department of the Army, the National Academy of Sciences, National Academy of Engineers, Institute of Medicine, the National Research Council, make up the National Academies. They are private, independent, nonprofit institutes that provide science, technology, and health policy advice under an 1863 congressional charter. Panel members who serve pro bono as volunteers are chosen by the academies for each study based on their expertise and experience and must satisfy the academy's conflict of interest standards. The resulting consensus reports undergo external peer review before completion. So that was written by the person to contact at the time was Jennifer Walsh, Media Relations. However, my guess would be the phone number is the same, 202-334-2138. And the email is news@nas.edu. So that's pretty interesting. I thought that was pretty timely. We're talking about the destruction of our... We're really talking about the destruction of our water sources, essentially, aren't we? I mean, that's essentially what we're talking about. So I clicked on the home page on this report to see what the... basically, the front page looks like now of this report in 2018. Let's see. Here, let me go into this one. There's a report. I hope I can pull it up. Some of these reports, oh, it's a video documentary. I guess they've transitioned into videos now that most people like to get their information read to them, told to them. Environmental Health Matters Initiative. It's a brand new initiative. Let's see what that looks like. How do I get there? Worldwide initiative to transform. Clicking on it and nothing happening. How about this? February 15th, 2018. National Academy announced initiative on environmental health. Appoint advisory committee. The National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine are launching an academies-wide initiative to transform how the nation addresses the complex issues associated with environmental health, a field that examines how the environment affects humans' health. The initiative will bring together expertise across institutions, including environmental, medical, social science, engineering, energy, and involve leaders from government, corporate, and academic entities to explore the latest science, identify promising solutions, and create innovative pathways towards environmental health. So I guess they're setting this up as we speak. This is dated February 15th. For more information, I don't think I'm going to go there. Okay. So I would like to go back to the first thing that I was discussing, because this is really interesting. This is an article that I found on The Intercept. And for me, this is an important topic. It's about the firefighting toxic foam, which most of us know that everyone in America has flame retardant in their blood, right? So that's just kind of, even people who breastfeed their children have flame retardant in their blood. If you eat a super clean, healthy diet, women that breastfeed their babies have flame retardant in their breast milk, and they're passing it on to their babies. And that's just the state of living in the United States right now. But I found this to be extremely pertinent. This is written by Sharon Lerner, and this is called The Teflon Toxic, Part 15. The U.S. military is spending billions to clean up drinking water contaminated with toxic firefighting foam while continuing to use dangerously new formulas. About an hour north of Seattle at the northern edge of Puget Sound, Whidbey Island is a quiet, forest bed and in Bob Farnsworth neighborhood, idyllic. In the 22 years he's lived there on Whidbey, where he served as a commander master chief at the Naval Air Base, Farnsworth, 61, has regularly crabbed and fished for salmon and enjoyed fruit from his own trees. His home, which was recently praised at $469,000, is less than a mile down from a fir tree-lined road from a sandy beach. Until this summer, Farnsworth, who retired from the Navy in 2007, had planned to sell it and move to Oklahoma to live near his grandchildren. After a 30-year career, Farnsworth has an enduring love for the Navy, but last February, he discovered a toxic side to the Navy's presence in his life. His well, which he had used to water his fruit trees, cook and fill his children and grandchildren glasses for over the years, tested positive for three chemicals that had apparently seeped in from foam used for firefighting on the base. One chemical, PFOS, was present at 3,800 parts per trillion, more than 54 times the safety standard set by the Environmental Protection Agency in 2016. Because of contamination, Farnsworth worried that he wouldn't be able to sell his house and decided not to put it up on the market. Suddenly, a place that had been a haven felt more like a trap. "We feel like we're hostage here," he said recently. The realization that he and his wife had been exposed to the chemicals, which have been linked to prostate cancers and thyroid diseases, cast the struggles they have had over the past years with these very diseases in a new light. "I don't know what was related," he said. There you go. Plausible deniability. After testing the wells, the Navy provided Farnsworth with several of his neighbors whose wells tested positive for PFOS and PFOA with clean water. Spokesperson Lieutenant Ben Anderson said the Navy plans to continue providing bottled water and ultimately provide a clean water source to all affected families. But many on the island feel the response is an inadequate fix to the contamination that has upended the lives of many of the deceased and decreased their property's values. I beg your pardon. "What the Navy is doing here makes no sense," said Stephen Swanson, a retired physician living near Farnsworth, whose private well contained 440 parts of PFOA. Swanson, who also has prostate issues, felt that the Navy didn't share his urgency about cleaning up the chemicals. "They're just hoping this will all die down and people will get used to living with contaminated water. Ding, 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 ding. Give that man a gold star. That's the issue of the day. They're just hoping that this will die down and people will get used to living with contaminated water." We have with the nuclear industry. We're drinking tritiated water no matter what you do. Back to the story. According to a statement issued by Anderson, Navy officials at NAS Whidbey Island, Navy Region Northwest, and Naval Facilities Engineering Command Northwest are fully committed to the timely and successful cleanup of the PFAS contamination, and it will be involved in all required actions until they are complete. Right. You know what that means? Somebody gets to make money in perpetuity. Contamination from the military's use of firefighting foam, or AFFF, isn't limited to Whidbey Island. The foam has been used on hundreds of bases around the country since at least the early 1970s to put out emergency blazes and far more often to douse fires purposefully set to prepare firefighters for those emergencies. Chemicals in the foam, known as and polyfluoroalkali substances, or PFAS, have seeped into the water in and around those bases. PFOA and PFOS are the two best known examples of a much larger class of PFAS molecules. Because mounting research links these chemicals with a host of health problems, including kidney, testicular, bladder, and prostate cancer, as well as immune and reproductive and hormone dysfunction. The contamination amounts to a seminal public health challenge, as Patrick Bressy, director of the Center for Disease Control, National Center for Environmental Health, recently described it. Yet, even as the Army, Navy, and Air Force have begun the slow process of addressing the contamination, which is expected to cost upwards of $2 billion, the Department of Defense isn't abandoning this line of chemicals. While some of this precise formulations that cause the contamination are off the table, the U.S. military is in the midst of an expensive effort to replace older form foam with a newer formulation that contains only slightly tweaked versions of the same problematic compounds. Though marked as environmentally responsible, this new foam contains PFAS chemicals based on slightly shorter carbon chains, 6 as opposed to 8 atoms. While many of these shorter compounds exist, the human body While many of these shorter compounds exit the human body more quickly, they still accumulate in the blood and other tissues. And like the longer compounds that have been the focus of environmental concerns across the country and around the world, these shorter molecules will persist indefinitely in the environment and never break down on their own. Hang on, I need to get a glass of a little bit of water. Thank you. As with PFOS and PFOA, the EPA has evidence that these shorter chain PFAS molecules accumulate in people's bodies and the environment, possibly threatening both. Some of the studies show the dangers of these persistent chemicals came from the manufacturers themselves, according to documents obtained by The Intercept. Wow. While several other countries have taken a precautionary approach and are using products without PFAS to put out jet fuel fires, the U.S. recently decided to continue investing in this line of persistent contaminants. As of December 15th, the Air Force had swapped out the older form at 173 of its 176 installations, according to the Air Force Civil Engineer Center, which provides engineering services to Air Force installations. 3 remote sites experienced seasonal shipping delays, but should have their older AFFF replaced by the newer version in the spring, according to the Air Force spokesperson, Mark Kincaid. Meanwhile, the Navy is developing a policy to require the testing, removal, and safe disposal of AFFF installed in firefighting systems, i.e., ergo, in an AFFF tank on a fire truck or on a hangar system over the next 1 to 2 years, according to Anderson, a Navy spokesperson, and will be replacing that foam with newly qualified foams. Newly qualified. Feel safer, folks? And the Army has planned and programmed funding to replace the current stock in fiscal year 2019, according to the statement from the Army spokesperson Wayne V. Hall. The Air Force has already spent $10.8 million on replacing and incinerating old AFFF, according to the Air Force spokesperson Laura M. McAndrews. The cost of that transition is predicted to reach more than $74 million as the process stretches on at least until 2020, according to a 2015 Air Force PowerPoint presentation. That document, she has a link to that PowerPoint presentation, so if you go to The Intercept, you can find these links. That document, with many others cited in this article, was obtained through discovery in a lawsuit against the U.S. government over PFAS contamination filed by attorney Mark Kuker, who shared it with The Intercept. Some of that expense is... Some of that expense is purchasing what Air Force Fire Chief James Podolsky referred to in an August 2016 memo obtained by The Intercept as a, quote, new environmentally responsive six-carbon chain formula, unquote, of AFFF. The new foam contains no PFOS and, quote, little or no PFOA, according to an Air Force press release. Instead, it uses the closely related molecules that pose many of the same dangers. And then they give you a big, beautiful picture of a wreckage there that they've turned out. The Navy began requiring its vessels to carry AFFF in 1967 after 134 sailors died in a fire aboard the USS Forrestal. The aircraft carrier had been off the coast of North Vietnam when a power surge caused a rocket to fire and strike a fuel tank, igniting leaking fuel and causing 9 bombs to explode. The fire burned all night and turned into one of the worst disasters in U.S. naval history. Lieutenant Commander John McCain, then a pilot on one of the Seahawks aboard the Forrestal, jumped from the nose of his plane and ran through the flames to safety. AFFF was a new compound then. Navy scientists had been working with Minnesota-based chemical company 3M on developing the foam since the early 1960s. In 1966, the Navy patented the material, which created a thin layer over the surface of the fuel that smothers the flames and prevents the release of vapor that could otherwise ignite or reignite. According to military specifications, the foam required a key ingredient, fluorinated surfactant, a chemical to help make the foam spreadable. 3M was the military's only supplier until the mid-1990s, when it was then joined by several other companies. PFOS-based foam was widely adopted. Eventually, the Department of Defense used it on all aircraft hangars, airfields, aircraft fueling stations, and other locations. The Federal Aviation Administration adopted the foam to fight fires on all commercial airports, and military and airports around the world also came to use the foam. But environmental concerns about the foam emerged as early as 1974, when a report from one of the U.S. Navy's research centers fretted over releasing a, quote, a large raft of snow-white AFFF floating into harbors, unquote, as was then the practice. Although the precise dangers posed by the foam were unclear, and 3M had reassured the Navy that the foam would have no adverse effects on the environment, according to the report, the authors noted that practically anything undrinkable by humans is unfit to discharge over the seaside into the sea, and suggested using foam made from glycerin and water. 2 years later, a 1976 memo about AFFF from another Navy research lab noted that improvements are desired in the environmental area. Navy scientists proposed changes to Navy practice, including testing for toxicity. The Navy did not take up all the suggestions. Wonder which ones they didn't take up. Probably the one for testing for toxicity, folks, as we can all know. I'm telling you what, this just infuriates me. It's like at every step. Okay, let's back to the story. Already thousands of gallons of foam were being dumped into the harbors in San Diego and Norfolk, Virginia. A 1978 report by the Naval Ship Research and Development Center authorized the continued release of the foam into the harbors, predicting that it would, quote, not be environmentally significant, unquote. It took nearly 20 years until 1996 for the concerns to revive substantially, and even then, no one yet grasped the tiny amounts of the chemicals of this foam could affect people's immune systems and change their risk for cancer and other diseases. Rather, according to the memo to the Navy Facilities Engineering Service Center, there was a lack of data showing the fluorinated molecules in the foam were biologically safe. Though they were still vague, the mounting concerns about the environmental effects of AFFF presented naval commanders with an ethical dilemma. Whatever unspecified health and environmental problems the foam might cause down the line, it was already saving lives by preventing catastrophic shipboard fires. Right. In 2000, the environmental worries suddenly became less abstract and more public. After decades of providing the firefighting foam to the military, 3M, the Navy's partner in creating AFFF, announced it would stop making PFOS, the company's patent surfactant, and ultimately the foam. At an August 2000 meeting at the Pentagon, an EPA staffer who worked on chemical risk explained the research that led 3M to decide to take its product off the market. She described one study conducted both by 3M and DuPont, which by that point was making a similar product. In the experiment, monkeys exposed to PFOS had lost weight, developed enlarged livers, and in some cases died within 3 weeks. Because some of the monkeys given the lowest dose of the chemical had died, the researchers were unable to find any safe level of exposure. Citing other research as well, she warned that the continued release of PFOS would pose a, quote, serious concern for potential future risk for humans and wildlife, unquote. Doggone it. According to an attorney representing the company, 3M generally believes that these chemicals present no harm to the environment or human health at levels they are typically found in the environment. Certainly, 3M sold its AFFF products with instructions regarding their safe use and disposal. It's not toxic because we say it's not, folks. That's why. While 3M's decision meant that its AFFF made with PFOS would no longer be available, the military continued using formulations of the foam that contained other PFAS surfactants. But less than a year after her first presentation, the EPA staffer spoke again at the Pentagon, where she reiterated the EPA's concerns about PFOS and her warnings were taken a step further. The EPA wasn't just concerned about PFOS, she explained, going on to advise the military brass not to rely on this class of chemicals and recommended a program to seek, test, and consider long-range alternatives. In the meantime, the EPA would be studying the risks. The EPA's interest in their products presented a choice for the chemical and foam makers. They could, like 3M, stop making the surfactants used in AFFF. Or they could ignore the warnings and stay in a market that, with 3M's departure, had just gotten considerably more lucrative. Shortly after the Pentagon meeting raised the possibilities that the EPA would scrutinize these other chemicals, the foam and surfactant manufacturers made their decision clear. Not only would they continue to make AFFF and the fluorinated surfactants, they would also create an organization to defend these products. The Firefighting Foam Coalition, with DuPont and chemical company Dynax among its founding members, was soon making presentations to the EPA and various branches of the military. Their messages were reassuring. The chemical used to replace PFOS were safe for human health and the environment, and AFFF was the only way to safely protect military personnel from fires. Wow. The Firefighting Foam Coalition was headed by lobbyist Tom Cortina. Cortina was an old hand at defending chemicals from the EPA, but his newest clients were facing especially daunting troubles. By 2000, some of the Department of Defense had raised the possibility of replacing AFFF with a foam that didn't contain chemicals that would persist in humans or the environment. The next year, the country's most prominent air safety organization, the National Fire Protection Association, held a meeting to discuss the need to abandon AFFF. And in 2002, a consulting company called Hughes Associates gave a presentation to a federal aviation conference that warned that the fluorinated surfactants in AFFF were among the most environmentally persistent substances ever, impervious to biological and most chemical assaults. As concerns began to swirl around their products, Cortina, joined by DuPont's Korzenzowski, pushed back. At conferences, in journals, and in meetings with the military and the EPA, they repeated a key talking point. Only one PFAS chemical, PFOS, had been taken off the market. Since their products didn't contain PFOS, their products were safe. One of the coalition's biggest tests came on October 2003 meeting that was part of the EPA's investigation of perfluorinated chemicals. The agency was considering whether telomers used in AFFF, as well as the foam itself, should be part of that regulatory investigation. Had the agency concluded that the other surfactants in AFFF posed a significant threat, that step could have led fairly quickly to restrictions, or at least to a voluntary phase out of the chemicals, as it eventually did with PFOA and PFOS. But at the meeting, the Firefighting Foam Coalition asked the EPA to exempt it from the regulatory process. The Firefighting Foam Coalition strenuously argued that these newer chemicals were safe, and the EPA basically bought that, said Rob Billett, an attorney who was at the meeting recently. It was so slick, he said. Whatever drove the decision not to include AFF in its regulatory process, Cortina was clearly pleased about it. I consider this to be a major victory of the FFFC and the telomer-based AFFF industry, he wrote in a memo to the coalition members that Korzenzowski circulated to his colleagues at DuPont. It was a major victory. Since then, the Army, Navy, and Air Force have continued to use AFFF across the country and abroad with little involvement from the EPA or pressure to replace its products. Evidence did eventually emerge that other PFAS surfactants posed some of the very same problems that PFOAs did. Over the years, you see this recognition even in Firefighting Coalition newsletters, said Billett. But they never went back and went to the EPA and said, well, you better come back and look at us again. According to Cortina, the Firefighting Coalition did submit data about AFFF use to the EPA, which subsequently phased out the 8 carbon chemicals that had been used in the foam. Korzenzowski said that DuPont and the industry group participated in the EPA process and met with the agency to discuss the chemicals in the foam. EPA had many meetings with industry representatives to help them better understand the various chemistries out in the marketplace once 3M stopped long-chain manufacture of PFOA and PFOSs in 2002, Korzenzowski wrote in an email to The Intercept. In the years since, while the EPA wasn't focusing on it, contamination from many different formulations of firefighting foam has been discovered throughout the country. In 2015, the Department of Defense provided The Intercept with a list of 664 U.S. military fire and crash training sites where AFFF have been used. Yet according to a March 2016 document, in which the Navy outlined its comprehensive strategy for perfluorinated compounds. That number did not accurately reflect the extent of contamination from the foam. The Office of Secretary of Defense responded to a reporter's question and in December 15 released a list of 664 fire or crash training sites. An annotated version of the document explained. But the fire and crash sites are just one category of potential PFC release sites. So this list is not complete or accurate. Let me see how much farther I have to go. Hang on. Ooh, it's a good lengthy article. Okay, well, we'll read as much as we possibly can. In response to the questions about the current state of cleanup efforts, the Department of Defense referred the intercept to the individual service branches. The Army, Navy, and Air Force each provided a list of installations without detailing the number of contaminated sites at each installation, greatly limiting the usefulness of information. Doing, 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 doing. Of course they did. No one knows how many people are drinking PFAS chemicals as a result of that contamination. In part because some of the investigations of military installations where AFFF was used are still underway. According to the list provided by the Army, Navy, and Air Force, both PFOS and PFOAs have been detected in the drinking water on or near at least 46 military installations in concentrations above the EPA's lifetime health advisory limit, which is 70 parts per something, parts per T. I have no idea what T represents. Many more people are exposed to the chemicals at levels below 70 PPT threshold. Judging from the health-based levels that states have set since the EPA set its levels last year, even these lower levels may pose health risks. New Jersey is setting forward with its 14 parts per something as its drinking water standard for the PFOA, just one-fifth of the EPA's number, and the recommended 13 parts for PFOS. Vermont and Minnesota have either set or proposed safety limits for both chemicals that are lower than the EPA's. And in December, a Michigan state legislator proposed the lowest standards yet for PFAS molecules, 5. Historically, chemical safety thresholds tend to drop over time as research mounts. Really? Okay, so the wide range of safety levels worries Aaron Weed, the town supervisor of Oscoda, Michigan. Although the fact that the PFOA and related PFAS chemicals from AFFF used at the Worth Smith Air Force Base has leached into local water was first made public in 2003, Weed first learned about it in 2012. Air Force officials presented news of the contamination as not that big of a deal, Weed said. That was the impression I got, that it was nothing to worry about. But it soon became clear that the Air Force had different ideas than Weed about the worrisomeness. Last year, he learned that the New Jersey's proposed safety levels, he brought his concern to a meeting of the cleanup team for Worth Smith Base, where the Air Force officials were discussing a plume of groundwater that contained 50 parts per, gosh, I wish I could figure that out, PFOA. 50 parts per, anyways. I'm going to look that up, PPT. I want to finish this article more than I want to know what that means. They were talking about 50 parts PPT as if it wasn't even there. So I said, why are you talking about 50 parts PPT like it's almost nothing when New Jersey says 14 PPT is something? A few days later, Weed said, he received an email from an Air Force official explaining that he was no longer welcome at the cleanup team meetings. According to spokesperson Mark Kincaid, the Air Force was working closely with a community living near Worth Smith Base and recently established a restoration advisory board to ensure the community has the access to information about our efforts on the installation. Weed was designated an alternate member of that board. The other question now dogging those living with contamination from AFFF is how many different chemicals pose a danger? The EPA has set groundwater and drinking water health advisory levels for only two compounds, PFOS and PFOA, the eight carbon molecules that have been used in nonstick products as well as firefighting foam. So your spray-on oil, folks, stop using it. The military's policy of addressing only these two chemicals flows from the EPA's decision to limit its own action on PFOS and PFOA. Yet clearly other compounds in AFFF also pose threats. After testing, Whidley Island also turned up six PFAS chemicals in the water there. Navy personnel arrived at Farnsworth House to present and explain the results of the testing as well. They told me the only ones I had to worry about was PFOS and PFOA, Farnsworth said recently. Meanwhile, Swanson, the retired physician, had several of the suspected toxic chemicals in recent blood tests, yet he said the Navy never spoke to him about the presence of these other chemicals or how to get rid of them. They don't want to admit that any of these chemicals are bad, Swanson said. The military is applying the same approach to remediation as well. Although multiple chemicals are known to have tainted the water at Whidbey and other military installations, the military is only attempting to clean up PFOA and PFOS. The only ones we have an active response requirement for is these two, said Maureen Sullivan, Deputy Assistant for Secretary of Defense of Environmental Safety and Occupational Health, explained to me in a June interview. The exclusive focus on PFOS and PFOA and PFOS means that some people who have a broader category of chemicals at considerable levels in their drinking water do not receive clean water from the military. Recognizing that PFOA and PFOS may well have a cumulative effect, the EPA set not just a safety level of 70 ppt for each chemical, but the same cutoff for both combined. Neil Sims, who lives near the quaint town of Coopville on Whidbey Island, didn't receive clean water from the Navy even after tests of his tap water showed he had four PFAS compounds in his water, totaling more than 80 ppt. That's because when it came to the only two recognized dangers, Sims' water had less than 30 ppt, well under the EPA's 70 ppt cutoff. But the test showed that when the levels of PFHXF, PFHPA, and PFBS were included, the totals were over 74. Wow. Richard Abraham, an environmental consultant who lives about 20 minutes south of Sims on Whidbey, was worried about the other PFAS chemicals found in Coopville as well, which provides Sims water and also serves the local school and hospital. He asked the hospital to install a filter that removes the chemicals. The hospital denied his request, and in an article in the Whidbey News Times, the hospital board member referred to Abraham as an alarmist and blamed him for causing unnecessary chaos. The mayor of Coopville told the paper there was no reason to filter the water and said that the chemicals found in the town's water do not rise to a level of concern upon EPA requirements. Wow. In January, the Navy announced its intention to set up a filtration system for the town of Coopville, according to the Navy spokesperson Mike Welding. But Abraham and Sims were right to be concerned. Regulators in Europe have already taken action on PFAS XS. Minnesota set levels for PFBS and PFBA back in 2011, and a group of scientists cited for health and environmental concerns when they recommended limiting use of the entire class of PFAS chemicals, which likely comprises hundreds of different compounds, in 2015. The state of Washington is working on establishing a lifetime advisory limit for PFAS compounds. According to Navy spokesperson Ben Anderson, the Navy will promptly respond to appropriate if limits are set for those chemicals. A little too late, guy. Some of the Navy seem to have anticipated the confusion that would result from singling out two chemicals for response, while many other similar, potentially hazardous compounds are clearly also present. A draft version of a March 2016 document of the Navy's comprehensive study around contamination from the perfluorinated compounds and AFFF obtained by The Intercept revealed an interest in limiting the public's knowledge of the range of contaminants in their water. Do we want to mention somewhere in this strategy that our sampling focus will only be on PFOA and PFOS? Nancy Neum, Chief Naval Operations Energy Environmental Readiness Division, asked in a comment on the document. Neum went on, I think it's crucial to ensure that we don't open the door for sampling to be done on the full suite of PFCs. Wow. No one knows the exact number of dangerous chemicals that escaped from the foam and that made their way into the drinking water, into people's bodies, but it's clearly not two, nor is it three. The number of PFAS chemicals the Navy tested for in some drinking water wells on Whibley in the first half of 2017, or six, the number that the EPA had tested in the drinking water nationwide, or even 14, the number of PFAS chemicals the Navy tested for the island starting in September 2017. Wow. The analysis of water where the foam was used, which was published last January in the Journal of Environmental Science and Technology, found 57 classes of PFAS molecules, each of which could contain many individual chemicals. Excuse me, I need a glass of water. Chris Higgins, professor of environmental engineering at the Colorado School of Mines and one of the study's authors, estimated that between 500 and 700 PFAS compounds had been found in sites where the foam had been used, though Higgins put the numbers of PFAS that are major components in the foam much lower, between 30 and 50. Still not good. It's impossible to find and remove all the chemicals, many of which have only been identified. The manufacturers themselves probably don't know exactly what was in them, said Higgins. In most cases, these dangers to humans also remain mysterious. While some of these compounds may be less toxic than PFOS and PFOA, according to Higgins, some could be more toxic. Further complicating matter is many of the shorter chain molecules for which the EPA has yet to set drinking water standards and the military has yet to address directly. And they appear to be more difficult and more expensive to filter out than PFOA and PFOSs. Oh my gosh, we're running out of time. Susan Gordon, oh man, we have a long way to go. This is quite a long article, you guys. It goes on for a long time. So look, I am going to stop here. We have less than a minute to go. I encourage you to go to theintercept.com and read the rest of this article. It will knock your socks off. Quite long. I don't think I'll pick up this moniker again. I'll be with you guys on Monday. I believe on Monday I will be interviewing Gerard Hay again. He's a guy I met online on Facebook with some pretty interesting political ideas. Put your courage feet on, you guys. As you can see, it's up to us to protect ourselves, up to us to out the information. Information's out there, but we got to get it out there. Take action. We'll talk to you guys Monday.